I am Kathy Bossert, interviewer for the Burnaby Mountain Oral History Project. Today is Wednesday, November 18, 2015. I am interviewing Dr. Leonard Evenden and Dr. Alan Seeger at the Clubhouse Restaurant at Burnaby Mountain Golf Course. Dr. Evenden, you were first appointed professor at Simon Fraser University in the Department of Geography in 1966.
That's right.
Retiring in 2002.
That's right.
Tell me what impressed you about Burnaby Mountain when you began your career at SFU.
One of the first things that impressed me was the distance to get to the top.
Ah.
Do you want to keep that going while we're doing this? Or?
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah. Okay. Although I'm Canadian, I had been doing my doctoral work at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And had learned that to cross the city of Edinburgh to get to the university, I had gone perhaps a mile and a half by bus or latterly and by walking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, carry on.
And when I got here, I bought a little car and I measured the distance from the university down to the intersection of Gullardy Way and the Lougheed Highway, I guess it was, and discovered it was 4 miles. That's miles, not kilometers. And so I had gone more than twice the distance to get to the highway from the university, and I'd had to go across the whole of the city of Edinburgh to get to the university from where I lived there.
And
that impressed me immediately.
Yes, now why would that be? The distance is just the way the road is.
It's just that the whole of Greater Vancouver at the time was so spread out. You can, in fact, draw a circle from a central point in Vancouver, and in a 10-mile compass radius, enclose as much space as they have for metropolitan Paris or the old county of London. So we are a very dispersed city, and SFU was out on the edges of that. That impressed me immediately.
Yeah, so where were you living then when you began
when
work
I first
at SFU?
Came, yeah. I roomed to begin with a colleague, Paul Carousel, who was starting at the same time, who had arrived a few weeks before I did, and found a house. It was very difficult to find living space, accommodation here when we first arrived. My wife and new child hadn't yet arrived, so I was looking around. And in the meantime, I bunked in the basement in the rec room of this other new colleague.
And was that in Burnaby?
That was in Burnaby. It was on Dunedin Street, which is not far from where we're sitting here at the golf club.
Uh-huh. So you were commuting up to the
commuting
university?
Commuting up to the university from Dunedin Street.
And what was that commute like?
Fairly quick. One thing about that location that impressed me right away was not the commute itself, but the strange smells early in the morning in when you open the door. And what the smells were the refinery smells, the early morning fog in, say, September, October, November. And that did impress me. You don't smell them now, but in those days they were quite noxious early morning smell.
And then you would be driving up the mountain, and what kind of experience was that, driving up the mountain and back down?
I don't know what to say about that. There's nothing distinctive about the drive. It was just a drive up the hill. The road had been newly built, and so it was a pretty straightforward drive. Later in the season, when the winter closed in, that was another matter altogether.
Yes.
By that time, I was living somewhere else.
And so there'd be snow on the road? And
oh, yes.
So was there more snow on the road? Was there more snow in the early days?
There were some dramatic occasions. I think probably it was around 1968. We had two or three very bad stormy days when we got ice on the road, and the road being quite steep meant that it was pretty difficult to get up and down. And I remember on one occasion in particular, I was driving with a colleague, Phil Wagner, who I think came in 1968, so this would have been 68 or 69. Phil had come from California and had never driven in the snow before, so he was terrified. He wouldn't bring his own car up, but he lived not far from where I was living, and so I drove him up because I had a VW Beetle, which was very good in the snow, because the rear engine weight in those vehicles was over the back tires, which were the drive wheels, and we did okay in snow. But I was also used to driving in snow anyway. So on the way down one day, we got not as far as the first intersection where you turn right to come back down Curtis. And just about then, we had an ice shower. So it wasn't just snow. Snow was already banked up on the sides of the road from earlier falls. But this ice shower just descended upon us. And all of a sudden, cars were simply sliding sideways all the way over the road. I went into a snowdrift. And then wondering what to do, I turned out of the snowdrift again and then immediately went back into it. We realized this was the way to go. So all the way down, we broke track, you might say, or broke trail. And that created a series of steps in the snowbank on the right-hand side. And I looked in the mirror and realized everybody was following us. And so we got down the hill all right, as it turned out. But that was an experience not to be forgotten. About two or three days later, a similar snow shower hit us on the Second Narrows Bridge going to the North Shore, and everybody was sprawling all over the place. I've never seen it happen since. That was a couple of unique occurrences. So I think, yes, we did get more snow in those days.
My partner at the time, Joanne Ray, who worked with Len for a number of years, she too swore by the Volkswagen Beetle, and she would rev it up the mountain, and it was so much fun seeing the gamesmanship among the drivers during snowstorms. Nothing gave Joanne more satisfaction than seeing people stuck with their vehicles.
Knowing Joanne, I can imagine her satisfaction.
Oh, yeah. She had a wicked sense of humor. Another important point to remember is that the zeitgeist of the 1960s, you know, affected transportation. Hitchhiking, which is unheard of today, was very routine, and the university actually had hitchhiking stops at the top of the mountain. If you were going one way, you went to one stop, and if you were going the other way, you went to a second one. So that was something that could only have happened in the 60s frame, and was embedded in this culture of how the hell do you get up and back from Burnaby Mountain.
So access was an important point in general terms, and these are specific instances of how we coped with it. Yes.
Well, I talked to Karen Morkey. I don't know if you know her.
I know Karen, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she told me that she would walk up and down the mountain,
yes,
or especially down the mountain.
She's particularly vigorous about that kind of thing.
Yeah. That was a wonderful way to get to know the mountain. Did either of you walk the trails at all?
I walked up the mountain on occasion.
Yes.
There's a miniature gym in the Faculty of Education, and there are showers there. So that was another good adaptation. You could hop in there and get cleaned up, because hiking up the mountain, it's a job. It's a job.
So, Alan, you moved to Burnaby, I think, around 1981, is that right?
Yes. I lived in the West End for a year, and it was wonderful. We had a community of carpooling people.
Yes,
there was more than one Volkswagen in that carpool. Okay. However, commuting from Vancouver never appealed to me, so I moved into the Montecito complex, which is over here, where there was a number of people from the history department and the political science department.
Oh.
So we had a wonderful community there. You know, we'd have dinners and these heavy duty chats.
When was Montecito established? In the early 70s?
Yes, around 1973. And that was regarded as affordable housing for the junior academics at that time.
So Montecito was created in part to serve the SFU?
Yes.
I should say...
created knowing that SFU would provide a market rather than specifically being built for us, if you know.
I should say that that was just Dr. Seeger speaking. And you were an associate professor in the Department of History at Simon Fraser University, starting in 1980, retired in 2014. And I understand you still teach in the continuing education.
Oh, I do different things, studies and whatnot.
All right.
And in the Montecito area, as late as the 1990s, there were local Burnaby people who had once lived in classic suburban housing, but they were elderly people, and they lived in the condos. And I remember Russ Hicks, a very good friend of mine, talking about the real heyday of Burnaby Mountain before the university came. I mean, it was not a wilderness when he grew up in the 30s or early 40s, but from the point of view of a child, it was. You know, from his recollection of being a boy around
that's
the mountain.
That's an interesting point.
What was that? It was like a wild place. In fact, it was a logged over.
Well, that's
some
a very interesting
before.
Point because I've just finished writing up a little summary of a project that was done some years ago, and we recreated the zoning map of the 1920s from the minutes of the city council. Later, they refound the map, so it wasn't really lost, but we had the pleasure of seeing that the map that was found actually corresponded almost 100% with what we've recreated, so their minutes were very accurate. The point I'm making is that the northeastern part of Burnaby was, for 1927, this map was completely unmarked, it's empty. So the rest of Burnaby was developing with street systems and this, that, and the other, and zoning ordinances, but the northeast was completely blank. 1946, there was another map, and it was still blank. There was just nothing ever thought of, rather than denying its existence. People just didn't think of it. It was out of everybody's mind. And that's how I came to think of it, is the northeast and the mountain were the afterthought in Burnaby thinking. However, it was never actually empty, because as Al says, people used it for recreation purposes. It had been logged over twice, I think. And so it was always part of Burnaby's existence, but it didn't have the same cachet as the areas being developed for commercial and residential purposes. And so when the university, when there was a need to find a location for university, here was this pristine location, which eventually won out because of the decision of the first chancellor, apparently, against alternative locations in Surrey and New Westminster.